You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works volume by Rudolf Steiner, 313. It is entitled Illness and Therapy, Spiritual Scientific Aspects of Healing. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on the 13th of April, 1921, translated by Matthew Barton. Study of disease ought to focus on the domain that belongs intrinsically to it, disorders that most clearly reveal an inappropriate influence of what we call the astral body. The disorders I am thinking of, where such influences of the astral body are most apparent, are those we locate within the area enclosed by the chest or rib cage. This domain is simultaneously the most important for the study of illness, yet also the most problematic for healing, or for understanding how healing occurs. This is the region of the human being which in recent times has most clearly revealed shortcomings in medical practice, such as those of Dr. Scheidegger, highlighted in the lecture he was kind enough to give to the assembled physicians during our first medical course. He showed the extent to which modern developments in medicine have led to advances in the field of pathology, yet, at the same time, to a certain nihilism in the therapeutic field. In fact, his significant comments require us to give particular attention to the aspects we will consider today. Disorders of the human chest and circulatory region are, in certain respects, very different both from disorders of the head organs, the human neurosensory system, and from true metabolic disorders. Nevertheless, they are intimately related to both of these. The head organization requires special treatment because, as we have seen, it is permeable to our etheric, astral, and eye nature. The organs of the chest are no longer permeable to the etheric, but only to our astral and eye nature. There, in the organs of the thorax, physical body and etheric body work intimately together, and this collaboration is a unified whole. In the human chest organism, we no longer find a sum of intrinsically physical processes at work, but rather an interaction of etheric and physical. What occurs there, and is of particular importance to consider for the chest, is basically a kind of plant development. This plant growth, though, is very much hidden within or modified by everything else related to it in the human organism. Nevertheless, we must take particular account of this plant process, which in turn encounters everything proceeding from the human astral body and capital I, and works in reciprocal interaction with them. Yesterday, I said that the astral body is the primary carrier of the morbid principle in us, and therefore the human chest region continually gives rise to the influx and influence of what actually causes disease. Within the organs of the thorax, pathogenic and salutogenic forces must be in continually reciprocal relationship. In this region, in fact, our normal state can only arise by virtue of the fact that we swing back and forth, as it were, so as to paralyze, through stronger health-giving forces, the pathogenic forces that are continually present, and vice versa, oppose overburgeoning and potentially proliferative forces from the etheric realm with the limiting nature of the astral, which in turn leads to pathology if it exceeds its proper bounds and takes too strong a hold of the body. These facts relating to the thoracic organs are particularly important because they result, in fact, from a rhythm. This rhythm that arises is influenced, on the one hand, by everything occurring in the head, and on the other, by all that occurs in metabolism. Therefore, the cause of equilibrium in this essential rhythm really lies outside the chest itself. And we can say, in fact, that the human chest organs only or chiefly manifest effects. Causes of disorders there, for which we seek a cure, are not actually contained in the chest organs themselves. In a period, then, when human capacities of inquiry have become far removed from a more intuitive and direct grasp of things, as exemplified most brilliantly in the Viennese school of medicine called nihilistic, because of its beliefs that one cannot go beyond pathology to arrive at therapy, such modern medical approaches have led especially to a gradual eradication of therapy, in the sense that one can't get anywhere with it. The brilliance of this school is apparent, nevertheless, in the way it has promoted diagnosis of chest conditions and complaints. Significant advances in the field of diagnosis of chest disorders arose here, with a prime emphasis on the advancement of knowledge, yet with the least possible outcome of such knowledge, since this approach does not at the same time take other aspects of the human being into account. This is why so little is achieved, really, unless supplemented by other findings, by insight into what occurs in the human respiratory and circulatory organism alone. Naturally, I would not suggest that such research is of little intrinsic value, but findings arising from, say, the stethoscope and such like, are only of major importance if complemented by understanding of the whole human being, so that one can then tackle things from a quite different perspective, making full use of what such a diagnosis can provide. Otherwise, the findings of such a diagnosis are really only of academic interest. Of course, one has to speak somewhat radically when addressing these issues in a contemporary way, but the truth of the matter underlies such radical formulations. In recent times, disorders that specifically affect the chest have been distinguished by attempts to divert attention from the real issues and resort instead to a somewhat mystical concept. While this concept does not have to remain mystical, it has certainly become so in the materialism of more recent times. Much has been made of endemic diseases in relation to such disorders. Indeed, the idea of such, in quotes, endemic diseases is clearly a large hold-all for everything that one does not wish to understand, and which in certain respects remains inaccessible to modern medical practice. Here I'll just highlight the rather interesting fact that the Viennese physician and professor Moritz Benedict conceived the, for him, somewhat strange idea of standing for election to the Austrian Parliament, backing up his candidacy by stating that his medical views compelled him to take this step. This was, he said, because so many patients consulted him for whom he was unable to prescribe what he ought, that is, better clothing, habitation, better air, and so forth. Such improvements, he went on, could only come about through social advances, and therefore, as a physician, he felt called upon to get involved in improving society. Here, in fact, one sees how the real problem is shifted elsewhere. Underlying all such things, we find something that is of special importance for this aspect of the human being. You see, the pathological process developing in the human chest organism, and ultimately deriving from an irregularity in the interplay between astral and etheric, also has to be seen in such a context. Here we will make no further headway without insights gained by penetrating a little into the supersensible realm. And in relation to this, the following has to be said. The process of breathing unfolding between our outer surroundings and our inner organism is really one that cannot be understood at all if we do not grasp the nature of the astral realm. The distinctive reciprocal action there between oxygen and carbon is actually a continual interplay between the astral and the etheric. Now I beg you to consider that we normally spend a third of our life in a condition, that of sleep, where a large portion of our astral body exists outside the etheric body. And here you can see the important way in which the astral plays into human health. It is, in fact, self-evident that the astral is still active within us in sleep. Yet, in this condition, it no longer acts from the head, but plays into us from the rest of the organism. During sleep, the astral develops an activity which must remain behind in us, in the right way, even when the astral that has emerged through the head is outside us while we sleep. Thus you see that simply by understanding the interplay between etheric and astral, in conditions of health and disease in the human chest, we can discover another rhythm unfolding in us, the rhythm of sleeping and waking. Actually, sleep itself, which as we will see is closely related to the process of metabolism, has less importance for the chest organs than it does for something else. And this other thing is in turn extraordinarily hard to detect. You may remember, if you were present at the time, the interesting range of symptoms we ascertained from use of substances with which we experimented here last time. Dr. Scheidegger demonstrated this on the board. But you will also recall that this array of symptoms consists of a great many isolated details, and that some skill is needed to compile and interrelate all these different symptoms. A difficulty may arise immediately when trying to form the right opinion about a condition in which, for example, you need to keep together the symptoms in the upper human being. If you then bring in a symptom which may be located in the upper human being, but essentially is merely a symptom pushed up from metabolism, you will be mistaken. And this will give you the wrong idea about the whole situation. So we ought not to overlook how difficult it is, really, to ring-fence the details of a particular syndrome in the right way. Readers aside, colloquialism here, to ring-fence, or I think to fence in, end of readers aside. On the one hand, it is certainly quite true to say that we can gradually acquire a correct, intuitive grasp of the relatedness of different symptoms within a syndrome. But on the other, while nature does help us, at the same time she makes it extremely hard for us to use the help she provides. In fact, nature unites and encompasses all the syndromes and does what we ourselves do when we formulate a comprehensive syndrome with all its divergent aspects. She does the same, but she makes it extraordinarily difficult for us to observe what she does. This is because she draws together the separate aspects of a syndrome in processes involved in falling asleep and waking, in the way we fall asleep and wake up again. What happens when someone falls asleep and wakes up again embodies nature's genius in drawing together aspects that come from different directions. However, physicians are, of course, very rarely in a position to base their understanding of this on anything other than what the patient tells them, which in most cases, and especially in the severest cases, will be imprecise. Of course, we can carefully observe a patient as he falls asleep and wakes up, so that what the patient tells us, even if it seems to him to be the case, may then be of very little significance. If falling asleep and waking up are disturbed, the patient will of course tell us things about this process, which, though living in his awareness, are unenlightening as far as a sound assessment is concerned. Here we have to look through and beyond what the patient relates. You can best recognize the truth of this if you try, gradually, to approach these facts and weigh them up carefully. Above all, you can experience the remarkable connection between the etheric and astral body if you observe how cares, worries, and such like work on in people. Here it is not enough to observe the cares and anxieties that have occurred yesterday or in the past week, which are ultimately of least significance, but those which arose longer ago. A certain period must always elapse between the time when worries or griefs first affected someone and the time when they have, in a sense, become organic, passing into the organism's activity. Cares and sorrows that reach a certain level of intensity always surface later on as anomalies in organic activity, and specifically in rhythmic organic activity. These may go as far as irregularities in the rhythmic organism, and only then can they work further to affect the metabolic organism and so forth. This is a primary fact that we have to consider. Above all, however, improbable this appears to a materialistic view, we can also observe that hasty thinking, without awareness of why a person is thinking the thoughts he does, a kind of thinking in which one thought keeps elbowing another out of the way or follows immediately and compulsively on another's heels, a common and harmful trait of modern thinking, works on in the human organism after a certain period has elapsed, and does so in the rhythmic organism. This is an aspect of very great importance. Psychological processes should not be overlooked if we wish to understand abnormalities in the human rhythmic organism, notably what occurs in our chest organs. At the same time, we can also include in this picture what we may call the periphery of the rhythmic organism, the rhythm of nutrition and of evacuation. By including the rhythm of nutrition and that of evacuation, we get a full picture of the overall rhythmic system. On the other hand, something else is of very particular importance. The other pole of the human being, that of metabolism, works back on the rhythmic system, and we can perhaps best understand the way in which this occurs if we know the following. Hunger and thirst manifest initially with great clarity in the human astral body. The way in which we ordinarily experience hunger and thirst is naturally as an astral phenomenon, astrally experienced awareness. We need to be quite clear about this. We ordinarily know nothing of whatever is not experienced astrally. What we experience etherically lies so far below in our subconscious that we are unaware of it. In daily life, therefore, hunger and thirst manifest in astral experience. But they cease to be astral in nature when they remain behind to be experienced under conditions of sleep. This does not mean, though, that they are then any less connected with the astral body that also works on in sleep, from below upward. And what proceeds from this direction, hunger and thirst that work back on the rhythmic system, when they remain in this way and work on within us, renders this system irregular by making it ill. This does not, of course, relate to the hunger and thirst we have felt the day before, which we take with us into sleep. It would be wrong to think that the problem arises when we go to sleep hungry now and then, or, if you like, when we go to sleep hungry over a longer period. That is not the harmful thing. What is harmful is for the state of hunger and thirst to become habitual, notably when this state is stimulated by a disorder of the metabolism, so that the rest of the organism is not appropriately nourished in consequence. Thus, the after effects of hunger and thirst are, in this regard, certainly a cause underlying disorders of the respiratory and circulatory organism. But if we now leave aside these effects on the human chest organs, the only other thing, a third factor, is the outer world's effect on us. For through breathing, we are, of course, connected with the external world, and its effects unfold within us. Here, remarkably and importantly, a whole range of effects unfold in what is enclosed in the human rib cage, and particularly also in the abdominal cavity, through the fact that rhythm reverberates there. Effects from both our upper and lower organism, along with effects from the outer world. A closer understanding of this rhythmic apparatus in us allows us to see that these effects unfold there, and we ourselves cannot remedy the causes that take effect there, but must seek these causes elsewhere if we are to properly alleviate them. This is also why this region of the human being is so clearly the proper domain for the study of disease in general, and why, by starting here, our investigations must then trace their way further, work their way through to other areas. The most striking and important realm of causes is really the one that lies outside us. For this rhythmic apparatus, engaged in the reciprocal action between oxygen and carbon, the chief astral influence basically lies in the external world. And here we need to discover how this apparatus connects and relates to the outer world. Spiritual scientific inquiry shows the following. The earth also has a reciprocal relationship between what occurs below its surface, and here the term in quotes earth certainly includes the actions of water, and what occurs above its surface. Basically, a process so far inaccessible to mainstream scientists arises between the earth and its surroundings. And this process has aspects of extraordinary interest. An excellent way of studying it is by observing areas of the earth where this process of interplay between the earth and its surroundings is a very intimate one, and where much enters the earth's interior from outside it. This is the case in the tropics. The distinctive nature of the tropical zone arises really from an intimate interplay between the external atmosphere, air, light, and atmospheric heat, and what is contained within the earth itself. And it is also no accident that we must look there in the tropics for what I would call a certain pole of magnetic and electrical effects. To speak metaphorically, of all areas of the earth, the tropical zone is the one where most atmospheric effects are sucked up. And this imbibing of what exists outside the earth gives rise to burgeoning vegetation. Toward the poles, the earth sucks up little of these atmospheric effects, resisting them, and as it were largely repulsing them. But in the tropics, if I can put it like this, the earth seen from without shines with least radiance because it reflects least back, being most absorbent there. At the poles, by contrast, the earth shines most, repulsing most of the external atmosphere, and thus shining and gleaming with greatest radiance there. This is extraordinarily important. By keeping this in mind, we can gain insight into the fact, firstly, that at the tropics a great intimacy exists between etheric earth forces and atmospheric astral forces, whereas at the poles, the astral is, in a certain sense, repulsed. By examining these circumstances further, however, such an insight can become very useful indeed. Let's assume we take a patient to a climate where the actions of light are very predominant, where the air is strongly illumined by light, suffused with it. If we do so, we can discover that we have brought someone to a region where we can basically divert the earthly influences acting on him away from him and expose him to influences coming from outside the earth. In strong sun effects, you see, there lies what the earth no longer uses or absorbs, but is reflected back by it. So, we take a patient to a region where he is exposed to these effects from outside the earth. And by doing so, by simply placing a patient in sun-illumined air, we work upon his rhythmic organism. And in fact, we work in such a way that an irregular metabolism is directly combated by rhythm, due to the latter itself being naturally regulated by such exposure to light. These are circumstances that lead us to understand the real basis of sun and light cures. And if someone has greatly lowered resistance to parasitic infections, a cure of this kind would be highly recommended. We don't have to subscribe to the bacillus theory, but just have to realize that the presence of parasites has deeper causes, which allow the bacilli to accumulate and persist. The bacilli themselves are never the real pathogens, but merely show us that a patient contains these pathogens, in quotes, within him. Bacillus research is important, certainly, but only as the basis of further inquiry, for the real organic causes of an illness lie in the human being himself. These organic causes within us are counteracted by what rays toward the earth from the surrounding cosmos, and what surrounds but is not wholly absorbed by the earth. Thus it is an excess energy, a superfluity of sun, light, and so forth. In other words, where the earth no longer only sprouts and burgeons with vegetation, but where it begins to shine and gleam, where, therefore, it contains light in excess of what it needs to sprout and burgeon, we have something of very beneficial effect in this regard. The following is also particularly beneficial here. If we find that a patient is particularly susceptible to parasitic infections due to an irregular circulatory organism, it is a very good idea, of course, first considering all other circumstances, a wide range of which we will meet in subsequent lectures, to take him to a higher altitude than the one he is used to, a greater altitude above sea level, and thus give him an, quote, altitude cure, close quote. And such altitude cures, which of course can be harmful in other circumstances, for as we saw yesterday, everything beneficial in one instance can be harmful in another, will have a beneficial effect on conditions of this type. Now, though we need to consider something else, we must not forget what is present in certain artificially synthesized substances I referred to previously, or the effects of these on people exposed to them, which we first need to evaluate. By, quote, artificially synthesized substances, close quote, I mean here substances and foods we do not merely consume as the given fruits of nature, but which we cook or in some other way prepare for introduction to our organism, for instance through combustion, and then intake of the ash residue or such like. Here we ourselves subject an earthly substance to a process which really incorporates effects external to the earth. Cooking and combustion do indeed raise out of the earthly domain whatever is cooked or combusted. So by giving cooked or combusted substances to a person, we give rise in him to an inner effect that is similar to allowing increased sunlight or the climate of a higher altitude to work upon him. We will also need to consider how we might now be in a position to encourage someone, on the one hand, to change his diet in a certain way, and on the other, also administer a particular medicine to him. This is in cases where an irregular rhythmic system becomes apparent. At all events, we must certainly consider whether we need to give him a substance that has arisen through combusting something of vegetable origin, for by combusting vegetable substance we surpass and outdo the normal vegetable process. I'm going to read that again. At all events, we must certainly consider whether we need to give him a substance that has arisen through combusting something of vegetable origin. For by combusting vegetable substance, we surpass and outdo the normal vegetable process. Through combustion, we extend the process with something that comes from outside the earth. Then the following is also especially important. Phenomena involving electricity and magnetism encompass a process on earth or a sum of processes on earth, which are inwardly connected with what we must call both earthly and non-earthly. The field of electricity and magnetism is one which really ought to be studied more deeply in relation to human health and illness. Here, though, we should feel our way very carefully due to the following. If you picture the surface of the earth to yourself schematically, here the interior of the earth and here what is above it, then phenomena of electricity and magnetism have a close connection to what is intrinsically earthly in nature. See also Plate 3. You know, of course, that electricity conducts itself from one earth conductor to another, say from one Morse telegraph station to the next. There is only ever one wire connection, and the circuit is completed underground. Here we see the electrical field, which the earth has already appropriated. We can say that electricity and magnetism are basically constituted by something that is both outside the earth and within it. But the earth appropriates electricity and contains electrical effects that really originate outside the earth. In fact, the electrical and also magnetic effects can be held back in the earth's atmospheric periphery without being appropriated by the earth. These are all the electrical and magnetic effects which we find in our electrical and magnetic fields. If we magnetize iron in relation to the earth, this means we turn the magnet into a little thief. We endow it with the capacity to rob the earth and retain what the latter wishes to absorb from the cosmos before it can do so. Thus we make the magnet into a little robber. It appropriates what the earth wants and has the inward strength to retain it for itself. All electrical and magnetic fields we have created on the earth are really stolen from the earth for our own use. And thus we inveigle nature into stealing, teach it to keep beyond the earth's reach what comes from outside the earth. And here we have something eminently extraterrestrial, which we cunningly retain above the earth, although the earth seeks with all its strength to draw it inside itself, in order to let it stream out from itself again. But we do not allow it to do so, holding it back instead from this activity. And this is why we must regard electrical and magnetic fields as excellent opponents of arrhythmic processes in us. Thus, really a form of therapy should be developed which specifically addresses severe arrhythmia or any other severe or mild disorders of the rhythmic system. In mild cases, it works even better by holding a strong magnet close to the human organism, not actually touching the body, at a distance that would need to be determined experimentally. You would have to try this out to get the right distance. Further to this, I'd like to suggest how one might best use our scientific findings, not so much in order to communicate an interesting fact, one not yet far enough developed to pass on to mainstream science, but to draw your attention to something which can guide and govern a quite different train of thought. The same Professor Benedict, whom I spoke of earlier, has undertaken very interesting experiments in a dark room on the radiance of human auras. These experiments have nothing directly to do with what I described, for instance, in the book titled Theosophy, although there is an inherent indirect connection. The emanations I described can only be perceived supersensibly. But between these higher emanations and the coarser ones, which the ordinary eye, EYE, can detect, lies a field that can be perceived in the darkroom. And Professor Benedict has provided an interesting account of what he found under darkroom conditions. For his experimental subjects, he chose, in particular, people who were sensitive to dowsing rod phenomena, in whose hands, in other words, the dowsing rod responded most actively. Moritz Benedict tested the auras of such people in the darkroom and found the following very interesting results: that the auras of people with a skill in dowsing are quite different from those of others. To be precise, the asymmetry of the former is very pronounced, so that the aura of their left side behaves in quite a different way from their right. The aura emanating from their head is also quite different. Though these results were greeted skeptically, they represent the beginning of recording the human aura through physical demonstrations. We must be clear, however, that such phenomena are only of the lowest kind and connected with our physical organization. The sphere of supersensible perception is not yet involved here, as some who wish easy access to it would like to claim. But it is nevertheless a beginning that could lead to a therapeutic outcome. One might investigate what happens by applying a strong magnet to the back of someone, say, with incipient tuberculosis, thus allowing such a person to be irradiated by a magnetic field, and enhancing this action by moving the magnet, held crosswise, from above downward and from below upward. In this way, the whole chest organism would gradually be suffused by the magnetic field. In applying this magnetic field, one does not need a light field, too, at the same time, for this would only disrupt the effect. So you see, one could perfectly well place a patient in a dark room and could soon perceive distinct emanations proceeding from his fingers. Having done this, placing the patient in the dark room and applying a strong magnet to his back and perceiving the subtle emanations from his fingertips, whose form will be that of a cone with outward pointing tip, we can be sure that the patient has really been suffused or irradiated with a magnetic field. You will find that this has a range of extremely beneficial effects for combating disorders such as those implicated in tuberculosis of the lungs. At the same time, such things demonstrate the great importance of remembering the principle that we really only have effects in the human chest, and that therefore, when we wish to bring about a cure, we must turn to our surroundings and use something that belongs to the world external to us: light, climatic influences, taking a patient to a higher altitude, and every aspect of the magnetic field. This is true, too, of the electrical field, but here we must give special consideration to the mode of treatment involved. Placing an electrical pole directly on the human organism and allowing electricity to pass through it is quite a different matter from first creating an electrical field and placing a person into this field without a circuit passing directly through him from one pole to the other. It will be necessary to experiment with such things, which are extraordinarily important. Under certain circumstances, one can also obtain beneficial effects by allowing the circuit to pass between two poles through a person, but the action in this case will only be one that works over from the metabolic into the rhythmic system. When I conduct electricity through a person, passing it from one pole to the other, and as it were including the person in the electrical circuit, only the metabolic system is affected. If, on the other hand, I place him into an electrical field, I will notice everywhere on him the same kinds of emanation as were found in the darkroom experiments, pointed rays on toes and fingers and so forth. And I will find that I can treat patients by this means, even those whose digestion and so forth is well regulated, but who show tuberculosis-related disorders. This is particularly relevant for disorders that arise in this area. Today, therefore, we were concerned initially with our external surroundings. I have drawn your attention to how, in sleeping and waking, nature brings together what is otherwise distributed separately across a range of symptoms. Tomorrow, I will come back to this, first showing the diagnostic importance of the moment of falling asleep and of awakening, but at the same time also examining how we can observe what nature tries to intimate to us in our waking up and falling asleep. Then, however, as long as we are aware of this principle, we can use it to regulate observation of our syndromes. And we'll find in particular that this can also give us an important pointer to the different forms of treatment required in addressing chronic and acute illnesses. The end of Lecture 3.